All right, I'll start off. We're going to talk about some ethics issues in business travel. I gave Rabbi Coleman a hard time today. I'm in-house counsel with a big company in the city, but I'm not here representing that company, so I didn't want to put on the materials who I work for. I don't mind telling you that I work for Sunoco, but this is not a Sunoco presentation. It's mine. So without further ado, we'll hand out some of the materials. And this should be, fairly straightforward on the American legal and ethical side. I think most of us engage in at least some business travel, and I put together just a couple of short hypotheticals. I'll try to keep it to 20 minutes and allow Rabbi Bieberfeld to fill the rest of the time. From the perspective of a lawyer traveling on business and how to handle business expenses. So the first one, our favorite lawyer, Hadley V. Baxendale, is an attorney with a private law firm. She's traveling on business for her client traveling to Japan. She's trying to close a major deal with a Japanese supplier. She books a first-class air ticket, stays at the Four Seasons Hotel in Tokyo, and takes the supplier's executive to a sumo wrestling match and then a baseball game. And then she purchases an exquisite kimono as a gift for her young daughter. So the question is, which of these travel-related expenses can Hadley charge to the client? Which can she ethically charge to the client? It's a real question you're supposed to answer.
What about the kimono?
Okay, why not the kimono?
Because that's for a gift for her family member.
Yeah, but it's a mommy's home gift. You know, kid, you walk in the door and the kid says, "Mommy, you're home. You've been gone for 2 weeks." How about the but for test? But for the fact that she'd been away for 2 weeks, she wouldn't have had to buy her kid a present.
Well, I never even charged for the shot glasses.
Of course, that's correct. You can't charge for that. It's personal. How about this other, the rest of it? I mean, that was the easy one. First class ticket to Japan. Now, my company doesn't let me fly first class. I go down to Houston to deal with those issues and on the Gulf Coast. Can't fly first class. Can she fly first class in this case? What would you take into consideration?
Available seating.
How's that?
Suppose that only first class was available and she had to get down.
Okay, you got to go.
Got to go.
Okay.
It's a long and arduous trip.
Okay. It's a long and arduous trip. And so why does that justify first class?
Because it would be going to Houston, you don't mind being pimped up in a seat.
3 hours.
3 hours.
No big deal.
To go to Japan, that would be more like torture.
It would. And from the client's perspective, your lawyer's going to get there stressed out, cramped, miserable. She's not going to be able to do a good job. I mean, flying within the United States, a lot of companies will tell you, sorry, you got to take coach. But if you're going to Europe, you can go business class, especially if you're flying like British Air overseas to England, fly the overnight and get those nice sofas that recline fully. So when you get there, you can actually do some work. Who's question?
This issue actually came up.
Sure.
I know the German company, privately held, that allows all of its executives, age 58 and over, to fly first class. And I don't know why they chose that red golf, but maybe the CEO.
Maybe.
Something like that. But have you ever encountered that?
Not an age related. So for me, it's always been distance. If it's a really long flight, you're not going to be able to work. You're going to miss a whole day from being jet lagged, and sometimes the client will pay for a better seat. Then never heard anything age related.
For example, you're also saying that she's on the way to close a major deal.
Right.
So maybe in relationship to preparing last minute preparations or whatnot, she might justify that. We're leaving a corporate jet for the CEO or the CFO to use.
Right. Okay. And then she's staying at the Four Seasons in Tokyo. Certainly there's a Days Inn in Tokyo somewhere. Why would she stay at the Four Seasons? Why would that be? I mean, I, can't stay at the Four Seasons in Houston either, so. What would be some of the factors you'd take into consideration whether you can stay in a five-star hotel? In Tokyo, no less.
Location.
Location. Is it close to where this supplier is located so that you can get there, right? And not waste time traveling.
But it has a kosher kitchen.
If it has a kosher kitchen, and I don't know about the Four Seasons Tokyo, but for sure you can get some good fresh fish, so you should be all right. All right. What do you think is the major consideration from a client perspective? Your client's going to see this bill for first class airfare and for the Four Seasons, which I can only imagine is, you know, $1,000 a night in Tokyo. What's going to happen when your client sees that invoice with those charges on it?
If he just landed a $10 million deal, he's going to sign off.
Really? Maybe. Would you talk with your client about this first?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, that's going to be the real issue, isn't it? You've got to look at the client's travel policy and see whether this is allowed because, like I say, some companies say inside the United States it's coach, to England or to Europe it's business, and to Asia it's first class. So if the policy allows it, or if you clear it with the client first. And the issue there is communication. It's got to be a clear communication between the lawyer and the client about the basis of the fee, right? But ahead of time, not afterwards. Because when a client opens a bill, and in most situations I'm the client in this case since I'm in-house counsel, if I open a bill and I see a charge from the Four Seasons, I flip. And I call my lawyer and say, oh, we didn't say that. You can't do that. I stayed at the Days Inn. What were you doing staying at the Four Seasons? So the upfront communication is important. And that's not only good client relations, as we'll see in a second, that can be an ethical issue as well. So look at the second page. And this is double-sided, so just flip it over. And you'll see the Pennsylvania Rules of Professional Conduct. Section 1.5 deals with a lawyer's fees. And it says the lawyer should not enter into an agreement for, charge, or collect an illegal or clearly excessive fee. Now, if somebody's coming to Houston and staying at the Four Seasons, that might be clearly excessive. Or if they're flying to Houston on the first class, that might be excessive. But to Japan, for the reasons we said, maybe it's not. So like all the rules of professional conduct, this has got to be bound by reasonableness. What is reasonable under the circumstances? And from a client relationship point of view, that really should be cleared with the client in advance. And there you find 1.5B down at the bottom of that page. It says, when the lawyer is not regularly representing the client, the basis or rate of the fee shall be communicated to the client in writing before or within a reasonable time after commencing the representation. So these are the kinds of questions that you would, as I say, both from client relations and an ethical point of view, want to work out with your client ahead of time. Yes, sir?
Is this rule been interpreted to apply to expenses as well as fees?
Yes. Okay. So it's basically, that is a very good question. This is called fees, but you got expenses as well. Does it mean the same thing? And we'll see that in a second. All right. Then I threw in a couple of issues around here about sumo matches and baseball games. We'll skip those for now. Let's look at number two. Ira Brevis, Esquire, which is Latin for anger is brief. Submits an invoice to his client that includes travel expenses. His administrative assistant has misplaced the decimal point, and the client pays $12,000 in travel expenses instead of $1,200. Can Ira just keep the difference as a bonus fee? Hey, client paid it. Why not?
No.
No, why not?
Obvious. Can't do it with a bank either. You can't do it with...
Okay. This is... you know, you didn't do that. You didn't do the work, right? You didn't work for that. And if you've gotten a fee arrangement in advance, you know, getting paid an extra chunk of money for doing nothing was probably not included in it. So that one's pretty obvious. How about the second one, though? Can Ira keep the difference as a retainer and draw against it for future billings to avoid the hassle for himself and the client? The lawyer's now got to go back to his accounting department and have a check written for the difference and send it to the client. And I get this check, and I don't know. My accounting department doesn't know what to do with it. I've got to find a way to get it deposited. Can he just say, I'll just bill him again. I'm going to be working for this client for sure. We're going to bill that much in the difference. I'll just keep it. Is that okay? Why not?
Speak to them first.
Good answer. Talk to the client first. And I actually have done this. I've worked out bills with lawyers, and I say, you billed me too much. And they say, all right, I'll cut a third off of it. Great. Just keep it there, and I'll run a tab. And when we use it up, you'll send me another invoice. So that can work. But look at the third page now. Rule 1.15, which is the IOLTA account rule in the Pennsylvania Rules of Professional Conduct. 1.15 says funds. Funds, A10 here, the very first paragraph, is the definition of what Rule 115 funds are. Rule 115 funds are funds which a lawyer receives from a client or a third person in connection with a client-lawyer relationship or an escrow agent. So it's money that you're getting from your client. And what do you have to do with it? B says the lawyer shall hold all Rule 1.15 funds separate from the lawyer's own property. And C says you've got to keep complete records of the receipt. And D says when you receive 1.15 funds, you have to promptly notify the client or the third person consistent with the requirements of applicable law. So you've received an overpayment here, right? Are they your funds? Is it your money? Well, no, you haven't, as we said with the first part of this hypothetical, you haven't done the work for it. So it's really not your money, it's really the client's money. So you can't just keep it. That boils down to stealing, is what that boils down to. So you've got to put it, call your client, because you are required under 115, D, you're required to promptly notify your client. Hey, I got these funds for you. What do you want me to do with it? You can keep it in your IOLTA account with the client's permission and draw against it if that's the deal you work out with your client. But you can't just decide on your own that you're going to keep it and bill against it. All right, the last one. Felix Mendacium, which is Latin for angry liar, is traveling to Harrisburg on business for a client. He pays cash for almost all his... He pays cash for his travel expenses, knowing that the client does not require receipts for expenses under $50. He eats at very cheap restaurants, obviously not kosher, but invoices the client $25 for lunches and $50 for dinners because that's the maximum permitted under the client's travel policies. So he's paid cash. He knows they're not going to ask for a receipt. And bills them the maximum. And then the client pays the invoice without question or complaint. Because they say, that's within guidelines, I'll just pay it. Has Felix behaved ethically? Client didn't question it, didn't complain about it. If he'd actually spent $25 on lunch and $50 on dinner, client wouldn't have complained. It was within the guidelines. So is there a problem? Okay.
Reversion.
Yeah. Sounds a lot like it. Let's look at, in the interest of time, the fourth page, Rule 8.4 misconduct. I mean, I expected you all to know the answers, right? It's ethics. You know, in your gut, you know the answer. When somebody asks you the question, you say, oh, that's wrong. And then it's a question of figuring out why and where it fits in the rules, right? Because we all have a pretty good ethical compass. So 8.4 says it's professional misconduct for a lawyer to go to C, engaged in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. By buying cheap lunches and charging $25, you have engaged in dishonesty, fraud, and deceit. Now, that's really broad, and it would be fair to ask, well, I mean, that's lots of things could fall into that. Does that really cover travel expenses? And the answer is yes. Turn one more page, and you'll find an ethics opinion from the Office of Disciplinary Counsel from Pennsylvania. I just copied two pages out of it. This one's a little bit old, but it is anonymous, so we don't have to embarrass anybody. And the issue here is, if you look under history of proceedings, the report said that the respondent, who was the lawyer in this case, was charged with a violation of the Rules of Professional Conduct 8.4C, which is what we just looked at, based on allegations that the respondent submitted altered billing sheets in the amount of $18,000 for false bills and inaccurate travel expenses. And the next page is just one quick page out of the discussion. This whole thing runs, I think, 30 pages or so. And the conclusion is, at the very last sentence, based on this evidence, the board finds the petitioner proved the charges in the petition by evidence that was clear and satisfactory. So they decided, yes, overbilling and billing excessive travel expenses and expenses for travel that you never took was, in fact, unethical and a violation of Rule 8.4C. And then just at the end, just two quick things. We won't spend any time on them. Under Sarbanes-Oxley, if you're in a publicly traded company, you're required to have a code of ethics, and that does require, under B2, full, fair, accurate, timely, and understandable disclosure in reports and documents that the registrant files with the commission. So if you're a publicly traded company and you're billing travel, you're billing expenses as travel expenses or overbilling travel expenses, and you're reporting expenses to the SEC as travel expenses when in fact you haven't incurred them, or you use them for personal expenses like buying kimonos for your daughter, that would be a violation of Sarbanes-Oxley. And that'll land you in jail, so I wouldn't recommend that. And then the last page is a page 16 of Walmart's Code of Conduct and Ethics. Why Walmart? Because they're the largest company in the world, or in the United States anyway. So you look at Walmart's Code of Conduct, and it says, we have a responsibility to our shareholders to use Walmart property and assets for Walmart business and not allow them to be used for any type of personal gain. So if you were to falsely bill your travel expenses, you would be violating your company's code of conduct and ethics, and that would get you fired. If it's a publicly traded company, you could be violating Sarbanes-Oxley, and then you'll land in jail too, and you've had a very bad day. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kurland. I think we'll switch a little bit, instead of the relationship between a client and the lawyer, to an employer-employee relationship. And to some extent, the employer becomes the client. And as the one paying the bill or giving the expenses, or giving the allowance for travel expenses. And I think of the three cases, seeing it here for the first time, I would maybe discuss number three. In Felix's case, where he was allowed to, by the rules and the code of the client, he was allowed to have lunches up to $25, dinners up to $50, that maybe he was not so much in the wrong. But at least let's discuss that and let's see if that's true. When we talk about taking unnecessary expenses, it's an extremely broad topic. Because if we think about it, if I'm working as an employee for someone, I'm working for a law firm, or I'm working for Walmart, really to take anything for personal use would be, certainly by Torah standard, by halakha standard, would be considered stealing. In Jewish law, there's really no difference stealing $1 or stealing $1 million. An interesting episode we have in the Torah itself, when Jethro, who was the father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, when he converts and now is a newcomer to the Jewish people, he has a great suggestion. He sees, as somewhat of an outsider, which is a good perspective, he sees that all the Jews who have questions are lining up in front of Moshe Rabbeinu and waiting to ask him their dilemmas, their questions, and he has to rule on them. And the line is longer than that in front of Walmart on Black Friday. And he says, this is terrible. Everybody's just waiting here. We have to have some sort of system. So he was the one who instituted the judicial system in Jewish practice. And he told Moshe Rabbeinu, he told his son-in-law, he says, this is what I would suggest. That as hadavar agadol, anything that's of big, something of magnitude, questions of that sort should be presented to you, the higher authority, but smaller issues should be presented to lower courts, which indeed is the system that we have in the American legal system today. You have smaller courts, you have city courts, state courts, up to the Supreme Court. Moshe Rabbeinu, when he repeats over the suggestion, he says, that's a good suggestion. Anything that's difficult, I will take. And anything of small matters, I will leave to the smaller courts. Did you notice the difference in wording? The Torah uses a difference in wording. When Yisro said, he says, any big case, in Yisro's mind, if you're dealing with a $50 billion Ponzi scheme, then Moshe, you take it. But if you're dealing with small claims court of an employer, an employee relationship of a few hundred dollars, then it can go to the smaller courts. And Moshe told him, no. That's not the difference. The difficult cases, that I'll take. That will be reserved for me. But the easier cases, and as it's not a matter of how much money is at stake over here, in Jewish law it makes no difference. Whether it's $50 billion or it's $50, stealing is stealing. So if we ask ourselves a question, I work as an employee for someone and I want to use the telephone for a personal call. Is that permitted or is that theft? I want to buy something quickly. Just go to Amazon and do a quick buy of some new slippers that my wife needs using the company's computer. We're not even dealing with what about company time. This is not on my lunch break. Maybe this is on company time. Is that permissible? So there probably is a certain understanding between employers and employees that if it's something that's of minuscule expense, like making a telephone call, a local phone call, and something that does not take up really any amount of time, it probably would be permitted. Yeah, but there are companies today that are hired just for this, to survey, to go hack into the computers of all of the employees, right? You can talk to, let's say, a telephone company or a different industry where you have hundreds of people on computers, private computers, doing things for the company. And these companies have hired other companies to keep data of where the employees are going to. How much time they're spending on personal use and how much time they're spending on the company time. And an amazing finding comes out that we're not dealing with stealing, but we're dealing just with a simple wasting of tremendous amount of hours, accumulating to hours and hours of wasted time, because once you start, Amazon is this price, but I can get it cheaper over here, and you lose track of the time, right? It happens all the time at home, and it certainly could happen in the company as well. So that's certainly an issue, which the best thing to do, as David said before, the best thing is communication beforehand. One should approach the employer and say, what's the company's policy? Walmart has a question and answer over here. Is it okay while I'm on the plane traveling, can I check up my personal bank account? Can I check my email with the company's laptop? And the answer here is yes, as long as it doesn't interfere with work performance. That's a satisfactory answer, and that's probably would be the answer of the employer most of the time. But to understand, those are real issues. From a halakhic perspective, those are real issues. If the boss happens to be a cheapskate and happens to be a penny pincher and doesn't want to allow any personal use with his material, not even a paperclip, well, if he's paying you well, stay. Otherwise, find another job. But that would be considered, it really would be considered stealing if indeed the employer would not give permission for that. Okay. But let's take it more to a travel expense case. And let's deal with an issue as follows. The employer allows, and there was communication ahead of time, and he allows for the employee to be driven to work with a car service, a limo service. That's allowed by the company. You don't have to hassle with your own car. You don't have to find parking. You call up the limo service, they'll pick you up from your home and bring you to work every day. Great. Fine arrangement. That's what we're paying for. We allow this payment. Since sometimes his schedule changes, so it's incumbent upon him to just touch base every morning with the limo service and say, I will be going today. You can pick me up at this and this time. That morning, he goes to shul, to daven, and his friend tells him that he has an appointment downtown. Oh, where's your appointment? Well, that must be this and this, the address, right next to his place of work, right next to his firm. He says, great, you know what, I'll go with you. And he goes with his friend to work. Can he then bill the company for the limo service, which he is entitled to take every day? Is that ethical? Is that halakhically permissible? Would that be permissible? He didn't have to use the car today. Is that permissible? A little variation of that case. Not that his friend told him that he's going anyway, he can have a ride for free in his friend's car. But instead, what he does is, says, you know what, I want to get some exercise today. So I'm allowed to take the limo service every day to work. Instead, I want to get some exercise. I'm going to bike to the office today. And he charged the company for the limo service, which he didn't use. And the cases go on and on. And here we're changing a little bit, that the company has a policy, which they have a certain amount that they allow for travel expenses. Okay? We allow you to stay in the Four Seasons in Tokyo. That's what you're allowed to do. He says, I'm not going to stay in the Four Seasons. I'll stay in the Days Inn. And I want to pocket the extra so I can buy all that many kimonos for my children and nieces and nephews. Can he do that? So here's a little bit different as the company has, and when you're dealing with larger companies, they're not going to go to have a meeting every time before you go on a trip, whether it's international or overseas. They're not going to discuss every case. So they say it's easier for us. We'll give a cap. We'll give a certain amount of expense allowance. Beyond that, can I pocket the extra amount of the expenses because I found it for cheaper? Now, certainly from an ethical perspective, from a Jewish perspective, if I can save my employer money, I certainly should do that. Okay? But I know what happens to be that when the CEO of the company goes, he doesn't try to save money. Whatever the expense account is, it is. Let me read here as a point of contrast. There is a book by Marvin Kittman entitled George Washington's Expense Account. And when Congress appointed Washington as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army, they offered to pay him $500 a month. He declined, the gracious fellow he was. He declined. And instead he says, I just want my expenses paid. Don't have to pay me a salary, just my expenses for my work as Commander-in-Chief. Washington used his expense accounts to indulge lavishly in food, drink, and other amenities. In the end, the bill he presented to Congress was $449,000, $261.51, far greater than the $48,000 he would have received in salary for the 8 years of service. Our leader, Moshe Rabbeinu, just a few weeks ago in the Torah portion, Parshas Korach, he says, you know, the people are complaining about me that I'm using the position as commander-in-chief, as leader of the Jewish people. I'm using it to maybe using nepotism, getting my relatives jobs. He says, I only do what God commands me to do. And as a matter of fact, I go beyond that. He says, "Lo chamor echad nasasi mehem." I didn't even charge them, not even for one donkey. One donkey? What are you talking about here, Moshe Rabbeinu? Are you referring to something specific? Our sages teach us that the donkey that he used, maybe even had to buy or rent, to come from Midian, where he was situated, to come to Egypt to then redeem the Jewish people. Who was he doing it for? He was doing it for the company. He was doing it for the Jewish people. Moshe says, "I didn't even charge him for that." I certainly would have been able to charge him for that. I didn't even put that on the expense account. It goes to show you, from number one, a Jewish perspective, and secondly, from a word to the wise, Moshe Rabbeinu says, "I don't want them to have any questions on me. I could charge him for this. I'd rather, I'll pay for it myself. It's easier, saves suspicion, and that would be a good advice of a way to go." But we can't do that all the time because we do incur expenses. So let me present to you here a very interesting case which has nothing to do with a business case, but yet something that we can extrapolate from it to perhaps our case of the traveler, the employee who goes to Japan, who is entitled to stay at an expensive hotel and choose to stay in a cheap motel. And perhaps it will also shed light on our example of the person who's allowed to take a limo service to work every day and chooses instead to bike to work, or maybe gets a ride for free. So we need a few issues we have to deal with, just with some background, okay? And that is, not to go into it at length, but the rabbis, in order to keep marriages, Jewish marriages, on a safe footing, shouldn't be disagreements about monetary issues, should be harmony in the home. So they made a very simple system, and that is the husband must provide for his wife. He must provide food, clothing, expenses for his wife. And in turn, they said, the way this relationship will work is that if she has a job, the income will go to the husband's bank account. He'll have to provide for her all the expenses needed. And if she has a job, the income goes to her. Now, what happens if you have the case where it's imbalanced, okay? She's making a salary of $600,000 a year. He's making $150,000 a year. So she has the prerogative to say, you know what, for me this setup doesn't work so well for me. I'll tell you what, I'll keep my own income and you don't have to pay for my expenses. She's entitled to say that. Since it's for her own good, she could say the rabbi's stipulation here doesn't work to my benefit. She's entitled to say that. Okay. But let's assume it's the other way around, and it's the husband who's making a fine salary, and the wife is making meager income. So her income goes to the husband, he has to provide for her. So the Talmud has a very interesting case, and we'll have to use our own imagination why this is, that the husband is providing money to a particular bank account for the wife. Let's say for a few months she has to go visit her sickly mother, and therefore he just has to wire money to her account. Fine. So he wires money to her account. Her mother lives in Japan, and she's caring for her sickly mother. She's going to be there for 4 months. He wires money to an account, an expense account, and there's a formula that the Talmud gives of how much that is. And let's say they made up with them themselves how much she needs for food and clothing and place to stay. And they make up that amount of money. And he wires it to her account. The Talmud says, if at the end of the 4 months, there's an excess, there's a surplus, she didn't have to use so much. Why? Because the husband figured she's not going to want to eat her elderly mother's food. And indeed, that's what she thought too. But, you know, Jewish mothers can be very pushy. And she demanded on cooking for her and making her eat. So there was a surplus of money left over. Who does that money belong to? In our scenario, in the way this setup is, who does it belong to? It belongs to the husband. And that's what the Talmud says. Let's now go to a different tractate, a different statement of the Talmud. Talmud's talking about a case of a woman who takes an animal and ties it to the temple and wants to donate it as a sacrifice to the temple. Essentially, wants to give money to charity, let's say. And the Talmud says, well, where is this money coming from? Where did this money come from? Well, the Talmud says, well, I'll give you one simple answer for that. One answer is that someone gave her a gift and says, this is for you personally, not to belong to your husband. Or she had that arrangement that the income belongs to her, not like the original arrangement we explained before. But that's one scenario. The Talmud gives another scenario. And what is that? That is that she was given an expense account to eat, or with places to stay, clothing, and she decided to not use all of that expense of what was allowed, and she decided to eat frugally and stay in cheap places, and therefore she'll have extra spending money for gifts that she wants to buy for her friends. The question is, didn't we say that the surplus belongs back to the husband? The surplus goes back to the husband? So Tosfos, one of the commentaries in the Talmud, lived about in the 10th century, 11th century, he explains the differences as follows. The difference is like this. If indeed the amount given for expenses was just overstated a bit, they figured this is the expenses, this is what the expense account would have to be, that's how much money the husband wired in the end there's a surplus. They made a mistake, it was too much, that goes back to the husband. But let's say the account expense was indeed on mark, it was on target. This is what a normal person would spend. But the woman on her own, in this case the wife on her own, decided that I will live frugally in order to be able to keep some of that money, which I'm entitled to. And that, Tosfos says, based on this Talmudic statement, that she's entitled to keep the extra money. Okay, do we understand the difference here? You hear the difference? Okay, so from the Talmudic perspective, the difference is there's a certain amount of expense, travel expense, that was given. There's an allowance over here. And that's based on what employees in this industry are entitled to, how much they need in order to be well rested. Now, we should point out parenthetically, if the reason the company is saying, I want you to stay in the Four Seasons, I want you to travel first class in order that you should be a mensch when you get to the meeting, and this person decides, you know what, I'm going to sleep on the subway, and he comes as a schmata to the meeting, that's the other way around. Not only can't he pocket the money, but that's theft from the company because he's not representing the company in the way that he's supposed to. That we understand. An extreme example. But if he decides, I'm entitled to stay at the Four Seasons, you know, they booked me for the Four Seasons, right? And then I pay for all my expenses, I'm reimbursed from the company, or they give me an allowance ahead of time, they give me a company credit card. I look online, you know, at Four Seasons, I can get a bargain. Instead of the Four Seasons, I can go to a Hilton. And that's cheaper in Tokyo. Can I do that? So it seems that the difference is, and it's a fine line difference, that it depends on the bother and the energy that's expended on behalf of the employee. Our case in the Talmud was with the wife receiving expenses for the husband, and we're just going to play it out with the employee who has an account with the employer. The employer says you can take a limo service to work every day. If the employer decides to walk one day or jog to work one day, assuming that this would not affect his performance, assuming it will not take away from company time, he leaves earlier that day, and assumes that he'll be at tip-top shape even from doing that. If he decides to go through that bother, it would seem from the Talmud's perspective, he's entitled to keep that money. However, if he happened to get a free ride with his friend from work that day, there was no effort on his part that was taken. In that case, what he has to do is, I just saved the company money. And as the idea is that we assume that the allowance for expenses are entitled to be kept by the employee, so long as that he's using it in the normal way. And if he doesn't use it at all, because he decides, I'm not going to use it. He decides, she decides she's going to eat her mother's food instead. Then that belongs back to the employer. It wasn't necessary. But where it was necessary, and then the employee decided on their own that they are going to sort of live frugally or go through the effort of not using that expense account, according to the Talmud's rule, the employer in that case would be entitled to keep the money. Any questions here?
There's a concept in Jewish law of geneivat deception.
Deception, okay.
So doesn't that play in this case and say that, you know, if the employer, you can't steal the employer's intent, and if he gave you that allowance to stay a specific purpose, you can't then, I mean, that should be no different than any other case of,
deception. That's the way it's translated, deception. So, if the employer would say, listen, I need a receipt of all of your expenses, every place you ate, every place that you stayed, that means he's saying ahead of time, I want to see the receipts because I'm only giving you the allowance based on the actual expenses that had to be spent. But if the company said, and again, when you deal with a bigger company, the way they deal with it is, this is the expense account. This is how much you could this is how much you're allowed to spend. So it could very well be from the halachic standpoint, if I'm entitled to that, it's as almost that they give me this bonus to be able to spend on my travel expenses. If I then decide not to use it when I'm entitled to it, then there's reason to believe that I could be able to keep that that extra. And again, the reason why it's not deception, and I'm not deceiving the employee, the employer. The employer says you could spend this much money on your expenses.
What is the latest acceptance of the doctrine that you just enunciated as having been adopted in the medieval times?
The
reason I ask that is that's a period when it was acceptable for individuals in high offices to live from the emoluments of their offices. You know, it was expected that they wouldn't get much anything in salary, but they could take things and that sort of thing. So maybe it was more acceptable at that time, more understandable. You know, what you're talking about is really a sort of a per diem arrangement in a way that where the companies say, well, you know, you get so much to spend $100 a day for meals or something, and we're not going to worry about it. It's up to you and spend it or not spend it. That's what you have.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering how recently was that accepted as being the Talmudic law for that?
Yeah, the reason why we date it back to the Talmud because it starts over there. That's really the genesis of understanding how the law plays out.
It's been
followed through. You know, when we say the Tosfos that we mentioned before, this, the medieval times, you're talking about that they are several centuries after the Talmud. And then this idea and this concept, this law, is then quoted as early back as 300 years ago. And then in the book I have with me today, which was printed within the last 10 years, brings this discussion as well.
So in other words, if this question came up today, you feel comfortable that the same result would occur on the top of a religious court?
Correct. You know, a scenario, somebody, the employer gives money for gasoline for the car, right? So he gives me money for gasoline, and that day I used my own car for the company trip. Can I keep the money? I'm not asking what everybody would do. We won't go around the table what everybody would do. But can I keep the money?
Well, it's the same gas. But are you saying that he gives you money to rent a car? There's a difference there. Right?
Okay.
You still need money for gas, whether it's your car or...
Correct. Okay. He gives money to rent a car.
Okay. But instead...
And instead I decide to use my own car.
Is it okay to keep the money?
Right.
I would say no.
So
See, our judgment on this is also clouded by Internal Revenue Code, which has a certain amount, and theoretically, although no one does it, if you look at Form 2006, when you get a certain per diem amount, because some salesmen are just given a per diem amount, but then they have to deduct out their mileage and see whether they're net ahead or net below. And by the same token, if the corporation to deduct it from its taxes, it needs to have documentation and to show its auditors. So where we're having a hard time with your scenario is, I guess, in the, you know, maybe if you're an entertainer and you have this entourage and they're supposed to get you everything from drugs to whatever and you don't care, and you know, you just give so much to take and, you know, and it never deducted, or they don't pay their taxes. So that's how I have a hard time.
Well, if that's the case, so then you're painting a picture that really the employer wants a tally of every expense used by his employees.
Right, even if he doesn't ask for a receipt for, you know, the miscellaneous. If you put $75 miscellaneous, you're in trouble. If you put $228 miscellaneous, or, you know, whatever. So, but what I understood you saying is it really depends on the intent of the employer who sets up the fund. And since every employer now is operating with the intent of whether it's Sarbanes-Oxley or Internal Revenue Code or all those other requirements, that is in effect incorporated into their intent. So their intent is not to say, well, you know, you go to your mother and have whatever it takes. The intent is, you know, we have to follow the rules on this under the document.
Let me ask you. A company pays for somebody's trip to meet a client in Orlando. He'll be there for 3 days.
And he also visits his brother-in-law.
He also goes to Disney World. I was going to be a little more exotic than visiting his brother-in-law.
I can't stand that question. I've been there 25 years.
Right. Do they deduct that from their business expense to the IRS? Because not all of it was used for...
No, but if I'm staying an extra day...
No, not so. That, but you know, the person's not working 24-7.
So he's going at night? When he goes tonight, whether he goes there or the hotel bar? And
right.
In fact, he's entitled to a dinner at Disney World because he's entitled to a dinner. So if he eats it at Epcot or...
So why is he entitled to, according to the IRS, why is he entitled to dinner at the whatever restaurant that he'd like? Because they're...
Have you ever seen what room service is in a hotel?
Right, but that's because they're leaving it up to the employer, a little bit up to the company, that you can say what is considered a business expense, right? And companies save money all the time from taxes by considering things business expense. So once they can do that and they consider it a business expense, then I'm just arguing that the employee could say, well, if this is a business expense, and this is how they're going to report it to the... So they were entitled to charge the $100 for the rental car as a business expense. And if I decided to be frugal and use my own car, which is certainly going to be cheaper than a rental, I should be able to pocket that extra money. Yes?
Shouldn't the employee have to pay tax on it?
It's income.
So, is there an
minus
obligation
expense,
in addition
right?
to what you're talking about that triggers him requiring to pay tax on it as income?
The question would, could he consider it as income, or could he consider it as a gift? But if once the company is considering it as an expense account, isn't it, then I'll have to consider it.
The NBA refs, there's a great case on this where they were given first class tickets and downgraded the coach and kept the difference. And they got slammed by the IRS for that to pay tax on.
Right, because that was income to them.
Exactly. But the NBA, their contract said they got to be get first class tickets, and that's what they were given.
It seems to boil down to the agreement between the employer and the employee about what this payment is. Is it essentially a per diem? It's basically income to the employee, and you take your own expenses out of it, or is it use what you need, but I need the receipts back. So what's the prior understanding between them?
But that's a great case. I mean, the only issue over there sounds like that they were just trying to cheat on their taxes.
Well,
right?
were they
sued by the NBA?
Not the IRS. It all got audited. Every ref got audited.
Right, but that's because they didn't consider it as income.
Correct.
But what about giving the extra money back to the NBA? And essentially, they took money which they didn't really use.
Correct.
Sounds like the NBA agrees with the Talmud.
Correct.
Not that I would use the NBA to bring it. But it sounds like that's what their understanding was. Their understanding, we have an expense account. We want our refs to be treated in the most pampered way, be well-rested when it comes to the game. That's our expense account. And indeed, if they decided to be frugal in their trip, they are entitled to that extra money.
Isn't there another example? When I work in Jewish world, when a workman is, let's say, picking dates, technically all the dates belong to the employer.
You're talking about the food, not the...
Right. Yes, I'm sorry.
Yes.
I'm trying to pick something you could eat at us. Right. Picking dates off a date palm. But he's allowed to help himself, a little bit, as long as it's casual eating. He's not saying, you know what, I'm going to make a date nut bread, and I think I also need to have a date chutney for my chutney business, so let me take six bunches.
Right.
So does that play into this employee expense issue? And I'm in the bank, and I also need a quarter.
In the law, we would say the rule of reasonableness or de minimis non corrupt lex. The law doesn't bother with trivialities. Yeah, I mean, are there those concepts within the Talmudic?
There's nothing trivial when it comes to halacha. That's what I mentioned before. So if now we know a lot of things when it comes to monetary issues. Yeah, with regard to monetary issues, many times the halacha will just say, as is stated in the code of Jewish law, we go what the accepted custom of that place is, the accepted custom of that firm is, right, or the accepted custom of the law of the land. We know, so that's what come down to it. Am I allowed to use the company phone to make a personal phone call? Right, so within within what's considered reasonable, you know, that would be permissible. Just to call my wife to tell her what time I'm coming home that day, that certainly I think would be accepted by the company. But if I wanted to call my wife to continue the argument that we had last night and go on for an hour, probably would not be allowed by the company. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.